Chapter 2, The Birth of the Two-State Solution.
Well, Hisham, you know, in Chapter 1 we talked about how this conflict got started with Herzl's The Jewish State, the Zionist movement, the Balfour Declaration, and then the tensions that started growing in what everybody called Palestine back then. Where did the two-state solution come from? I think most people think it's a relatively recent thing, but I don't think so. I think it started way back a long time ago. From your perspective as a Palestinian, where does this two-state solution come from?
Well, it started as early as 1937, Mark. Back then, the British, as we have stated earlier, tried unsuccessfully to quell the Palestinian rebellion, the Palestinian Intifada then, militarily. But that didn't work out. Therefore, the British turned to their traditional political means by sending a committee of inquiry, supposedly to investigate the situation. That commission was called the Peel Commission, and it came up with a report called the Peel Commission Report back then in 1937, in which it suggested that a way out is to divide Palestine into two entities. Of course, the Palestinians were in no way to accept such a division because it really meant an impingement on their territorial rights, on the totality of their national patrimony. So the Intifada continued, the rebellion continued, until 1939, when the British issued what was known as the White Paper. Well, by then, it, as could be expected, the Palestinians were really exhausted. So many killings, so many injuries,
well, Hisham, elaborate,
so many arrests.
Elaborate a little bit on that. I recall there were major tensions in 1929, then there was some big strike. Essentially, the Intifada that we talk about in the last 20, 30 years, actually there were Intifadas way back then, if I remember right. And what are the details of that? How did these rebellions begin?
Oh, absolutely. They started really as the moment it became clear for the Palestinians that the British were aiding the Zionist movement to take over Palestine immediately after the Balfour Declaration, protests and demonstrations began all throughout the late throughout the 1920s. Demonstrations were all over Palestine, but really the main Intifada, if you will, was in back in 1929. It was called the Burak Uprising. The Burak Wall is where the Prophet Muhammad, it was said, went up to heavens. At any rate, and then since then, tensions were mounting, more and more demonstrations and uprising, until 1936, where the Palestinians declared the longest strike in recorded history for 6 months against the British. There was a total civil disobedience, and there was a rebellion, a big uprising against the British mandatory power, and against the Zionist takeover of Palestine. It was then when the British really instituted their harsh measures against the Palestinians, where they built prisons to incarcerate Palestinians, where they really killed many Palestinians, including some famous Palestinian leaders. So that was a very violent period, and the British did not succeed, although they sent tens of thousands of British troops to the field in Palestine to put down the uprising. That didn't succeed, and therefore they resorted to their traditional diplomatic means by sending commissions of inquiries to look into the situation, as they usually do, in an attempt to tranquilize the indigenous population, to send them a mistaken message, a false message, that they, i.e. the British, were looking into the situation positively. And that's when the Peel Commission report came out, suggesting that one way out is by dividing Palestine. And as I said earlier, that didn't work out because Palestinians, considered Palestine, the whole of Palestine, to be theirs, and they were living in the whole of Palestine. So that lasted until 1939. By then, the Palestinians were exhausted, the British were exhausted, World War II was on its way, and the British felt that they badly need their troops somewhere else in the world. They cannot keep close to 56,000 troops in Palestine just to put down the uprising. So
from the Palestinian,
an extra step further.
From the Palestinian point of view, then, the rebellion, the resistance, the refusal to allow Palestine to be divided or taken over by others really goes back to the 20s and 30s, and there were already international investigations, and this is where the birth of the idea, hey, let's solve this with a two-state solution, which at the time the Palestinians totally rejected.
Absolutely. I think that's well said, Mark. Palestinian resistance to the colonization of their country really started from the very moment the colonial project was made clear. It never stopped up until today. Yes, there were lapses every now and then, as is usually the case, but the idea to not allow any foreign takeover of their country was always deeply rooted in Palestinian consciousness from the very beginning. So Palestinian resistance is at least is more than a century or one century old. I mean, it has been going on and on and on nonstop.
And that,
you can imagine, of course, how many losses.
That also would explain why the Zionist leaders, the official Zionist leaders, even at the time of the Balfour Declaration and into the 20s and early 30s, they were making statement after statement trying to reassure the Palestinians, oh, we don't intend to take your country. We don't intend to set up a Jewish state. We just want to live here with you, and we have immigrants who want to come here. I mean, I recall many from my research official Zionist statements. Maybe that began to change at the time of the Peel Commission. I mean, they must have thought that was a major victory for them, that the idea that at least part of Palestine would become a Jewish state.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the Zionists knew quite well that Britain was already committed through the Balfour Declaration and that Britain was complicit in assisting them to establish their own entity. I mean, the Zionists knew that very, very, very well. And in actuality, everything that the British were doing on the ground was to assist the Zionist movement dig in and uproot the indigenous people.
Including Herbert Samuel, as I recall, who was a Zionist Jew himself, appointed by the British to administer Palestine. But then, Hisham, what happened in 1939? It seems the British, as you say, were exhausted, and they went back on the idea of a partition. And so what happened then?
Sure, absolutely. But just one more about Herbert Samuel. You're absolutely right. I mean, he was the British High Commissioner. He was a devout Zionist. And my goodness, what Herbert Samuel did to aid the Zionist movement is unmistakable. So in 1939, as I said, as the Palestinians were getting exhausted, as the British were in need of their troops somewhere else, the British issued what they called a white paper. Now, in that white paper, they said several things, but mainly they said, okay, that they will restrict Jewish immigration to Palestine, because that was one of the concerns of the Palestinian people, that immigration, illegal immigration, was increasing against the desires and against the rights of the indigenous people. The British also said that they would slow down the confiscation of land and the imposition of high and unfair taxes on Palestinian property. And they also said, and this is, I think, the key point that concerns us here, Mark, that they do promise Arab independence in 10 years, which, in a way, signified the idea of partition in the form of an independent Arab state next to a Jewish state. Now, the Palestinians accepted the white paper because they were absolutely concerned. They were fatigued. They were exhausted. The Zionist movement vehemently rejected it because they did not want any limitation of immigration or any reduction of the confiscation of land. So they refused the white paper, but...
One does have to factor in that European anti-Semitism was on the rise, that Jews were looking for places to emigrate to, not just to Palestine, but they were still... Well, the gates of America weren't as open as they were before. But it sounds like, in a sense, there was a settlement freeze almost. I mean, you know, here we're discussing settlement freeze at this time in history. But it sounds like the British were kind of promising they were going to freeze this, they were going to lessen this, they were going to make sure Palestinian rights were fulfilled. So in a sense, Palestinians have been getting these promises for 80, 90 years. No wonder they're fed up.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And there were campaigns of deception all along. But see, ironically, you're right that, hatred of Jews, discriminatory practices were on the rise in Europe, certainly not in Palestine. And ironically, the doors of immigration to the United States were getting tighter and tighter by the day. Nonetheless, and this is one of those ironies of history, the Zionist movement calculated, well, I believe, that Britain was no longer to remain as the superpower of the time, especially as World War II was approaching. They moved their headquarters to the United States, although the doors of immigration in the United States were not open to survivors of the Holocaust as they should have been from the start. Now, interestingly enough, there is another landmark event which we should not really overlook in the discussion, in our discussion of the two-state solution or the way the two-state idea came about. And that was in 1942. The Zionist movement held what came to be known as the Biltmore, the Biltmore program, because there was a conference for the Zionist movement held at the Biltmore Hotel in New York, and they issued the Biltmore program in which they said that their idea of the national home means the establishment of a Jewish commonwealth in Palestine. So here was another facet of that discussion. What does the commonwealth mean? Does it mean a state? Does it mean something beyond the national home? But in my view, this was yet another further elaboration of what the Zionists were about to establish in Palestine.
Well, your mention,
nothing short of a state.
Your mention of the Biltmore Conference is very important in terms of Jewish American Zionist influence. The Zionist movement was never the majority of movement in the 20s and 30s. In fact, most American Jews were busy assimilating. And the Biltmore Conference, as I recall, symbolized the first time that official institutions in American Jewry went along with the Zionist program. They'd been very reluctant, very worried that Americans might then sort of type Jews as duly loyal and or say to Jews, you know, why are you living here if Israel and Zionism are your ideologies? So, okay, then we're already in World War II. What's happening in Palestine during this time? What's the Palestinian community doing?
Fatigue, exhaustion, disappointment. discouragement that the 3-year-old uprising did not achieve its objectives. In other words, the situation in Palestine was one of regression rather than progression. The traditional leadership, that of Hajj Mufti Amin al-Husseini, did not prove to be successful. There were intra-Palestinian struggles between traditional families, each wanting to take over the leadership. That is the struggle during the 1930s between the Husseinis and the Nashashibis has really further exhausted the society and has further ruptured its morale. So the 1940s were tough, in my view, for the Palestinians until the British mandate unequivocally declared that it wants to hand over its the control of Palestine to the United Nations in 1947. Now, while the Holocaust was taking place and while Jews were persecuted in Nazi Germany, immigration mounted. Truman, well, first Roosevelt and then Truman also made sure to allow, to enable more Jewish immigrants to go to Palestine. So the 1940s were really a decade, especially, I mean, before the war, were a decade of terrible setbacks for the Palestinians. But as Britain became weaker, as Britain emerged out of the war, although one of the victorious powers, but rather relatively broken, certainly no longer a superpower, under the rubric of that weakness, it declared that it wants to hand over the administration of Palestine to the United Nations. But in my view, I think that period was enough for Britain to assist the Zionist movement to begin and to solidify its position. The Zionists were impatient, as we know, from terrorist organizations like the Irgun and the Stern Gang were quite impatient, and they launched terrorist attacks against the British themselves. They wanted to hasten the withdrawal of Britain from Palestine,
well,
and the handing over of Palestine to them.
You know, your description of how the Palestinians were exhausted, they had already attempted to stop their country being taken from them. But from the Jewish point of view and from the American point of view, as World War II went on, 42, 43, 44, as the details of the Holocaust started to become known, so you had this tremendous upsurge in concern about Jewish survival at the time, tremendous guilt of American Jews that they were not able to help the Jewish communities of Europe. In most cases, these were family members, like my family. In fact, my mom and dad, they were their families got to the United States before World War II, but almost the entire families that were left in Europe were destroyed and never found again. So the Zionist movement gained tremendously in power, in sympathy. American Jews were getting more assimilated and more powerful here in the United States. And then, as you say, President Truman took the positions he did against the advice of Secretary of State Marshall and Secretary of Defense Forrestal, who foresaw that accepting the idea of forcing partition upon Palestine would probably ignite a war that would go on in unending ways and seriously threaten American interests, which is exactly, of course, what has happened since. So all these factors were coming into play, and it was a world before Facebook and YouTube and phones, so each community was kind of cut off from each other, getting news a little bit here, a little bit there. As the war ended, and as the British began, said they needed to withdraw, what was the attitude of the Palestinian community then?
It was still one of shock. The British handed over the question of Palestine to the United Nations. The United Nations, of course, was under really the control of the United States to a great extent. The United Nations formed a committee called UNSCOP, the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine, to look into the situation. There were two opinions. There was the majority opinion. There was the minority opinion. The committee, the majority opinion was that the solution lies in the partitioning of Palestine into two states, one Jewish, one Arab, and keeping Jerusalem, assigning Jerusalem international status. The minority opinion was different. It was basically more of a unitary approach. At any rate, the idea of partition officially was implanted in the approach of the United Nations. The United Nations General Assembly conducted a straw vote on November 26, 1947, to see if the idea of partition will gain or could gain enough support, but the straw vote failed. There weren't enough votes to support the idea of partition. So the United Nations, the United States, exactly as you stated, the Truman administration turned to the world and used its diplomatic weight around the world against the advice of the Secretary of State and others, and threatened small countries that unless they support the partition resolution, they would lose foreign aid from the United States. The United States will cut off the aid that was given to them, like the Philippines or Uruguay and others. So 3 days later, on November 29, the United Nations General Assembly passed Resolution 181, partitioning Palestine into two states, one Jewish, one Arab, allotting the majority of the country to the Jews, who were a minority. The Jews were 30% of the population in Palestine, including many illegal immigrants to Palestine. But they were given 56% of the land, and I should really comment as a Palestinian that they were given the best of the land, the most fertile, the most strategically located, the coastal areas. And the Arabs, who were 70% of the population, were allotted only 43% of the land, much of which is desolate as far as I'm concerned as a Palestinian. Of course, the Palestinians vehemently rejected the partition resolution. They considered it to be a violation of their rights. They were never consulted about it. Their voices were never heard. Nobody even was concerned about how they felt. And the Palestinians felt that that resolution basically is an institutionalization of the occupation of their country. The Zionists could hardly believe their ears when they heard that the resolution was passed. They immediately hastened to put that resolution into effect. Now, let's keep in mind from a legal point of view that that resolution was passed by the General Assembly, and accordingly, it should have been treated as a recommendatory resolution, not as a binding resolution, because resolutions passed by the General Assembly are recommendatory in nature, while those passed by the Security Council have a binding power. But that resolution was treated as a binding resolution. The Zionist movement immediately jumped on the bandwagon and started putting that resolution into effect by committing a number of massacres against Palestinians in Deir Yassin and in many other Palestinian villages in late 1947 and the first half of 1948, the objective of which is to drive the Palestinian people out of their homes and property by force.
Well, Hisham, we can get into what happened in 48 and the birth of Israel in our next chapter, but there's a concluding part that I'd like to add to this chapter about the birth of the two-state solution. at the time, the representative of the Jewish community and the personal representative of Ben-Gurion in Washington was a man by the name of Dr. Nachum Goldman. Goldman himself was working very hard with Forrestal and with General Marshall, the Secretary of State, because he foresaw this unending conflict if, in fact, the Jewish community simply declared statehood. He knew it would lead to war, and he foresaw that it would be a war that would go on for a very long time. So here was the man who had founded the World Jewish Congress and the World Zionist Organization working in Washington to actually delay the any declaration of statehood because he was desperate to find some way of accommodation, whether it would be a binational state or whether there would be some kind of way to agree. We never got to that point because not only was he overruled, but Truman overruled his own foreign policy people. As I recall, I don't remember all the details, but even when the UN passed the partition resolution, the Secretary of State wanted very much to get things delayed and to see what kind of diplomacy could be brought to bear, and Goldman was involved in that. And there was a moment at which the President in the White House actually picked up the phone and called the UN representative and countermanded the orders of the Secretary of State, and that's the birth of Israel, and that's the birth of the conflict, and that's also kind of the end of the two-state solution for a while.
That is certainly true.
All right. In the next chapter, we'll take a look at the 48 war, the birth of Israel, what happened to the Palestinian community, and how the Zionist movement celebrated its victory.